Our next case today is Tandia against the Attorney General, the number 06-2471. Mr. Sharma Crawford.
May it please the Court. Counsel, my name is William Sharma Crawford, and I represent Mamadou Tandia in this matter. In this matter, we're seeking that the Court reverse the immigration judge's decision denying his claim for asylum from Mauritania. The immigration judge's decision focuses on two areas, as is common in an asylum claim: the credibility of the person testifying, and then clearly the persecution feared by the petitioner. I'll take these in the two pieces as they arise. First, the credibility determination, as the judge made an adverse credibility decision finding regarding Mr. Tandia. The immigration judge's credibility finding rests on four issues, two of which are combined because they have to do with a set of dates. So the first one is the dates when Mr. Tandia began school. In his first application for asylum, Mr. Tandia states that he began school in 1998. And when he testifies, he states emphatically that he began school in May of 2000 and that he ended in December of 2000, with an intervening persecution or arrest in August of 2000. The judge uses this discrepancy to point out Mr. Tandia's lack of credibility. However, an examination of the record reveals that Mr. Tandia testifies that in 1998 he began review classes and didn't begin full-fledged education until 2000, which is a consistency. It's not an inconsistency. And the second piece that we would point out is to this regard is it doesn't make any difference, even assuming arguendo that it's an error, that Mr. Tandia didn't go to school in 1998. It's immaterial to his claim. He's consistent in that he was arrested in August of 2000. There is no inconsistency there, so whether he started school in 1998 or started school in 2000, it's immaterial. But we would put forth that it is not an inconsistency. The second piece that the judge seizes on, which is actually his third point, but the second for analysis, is that Mr. Tandia left Mauritania on a validly issued government passport, and therefore there's no way he could be persecuted were he to return to Mauritania, as Mr. Tandia alleges. The problem with this is that Mr. Tandia was required to bribe someone to obtain the passport. So the government's allegation, or the judge's assertion that it's a validly obtained passport, seems to fall flat when it's obtained by bribery, although the immigration judge makes the assumption that bribery is commonplace in Africa. There's no evidence in the record to support that. The government doesn't provide to say this is how passports are obtained in Mauritania. There's nothing to support that judge's allegation. So therefore, Mr. Tandia's fear that he'll return and be questioned by authorities on how did you get this passport is credible. So it's not a basis for incredibility, but rather it's a credible fear. And the last piece is his unclear testimony, his unclear presentation. I would remind this court that this hearing was held twice, the first time because of poor translation, and so the second time again it was conducted through translation. It's a very difficult and arduous process to conduct an asylum hearing with a translator who's on a telephone and a judge that's on a video camera. It becomes a very slow process and much is lost. We're not alleging.
It says the location was Kansas City. Is that where you were located with your client?
I wasn't the trial attorney, Your Honor, but yes, the Mr. Tandia was located physically present in Kansas City with government counsel and his representation, Ms. Slisher, at that time. The judge appeared televideo from Chicago. Judge Brajos was seated here, and usually a translator, and I don't know if a translator was present in the courtroom, present in Judge Brajos' courtroom, or by telephone.
Where was your client?
He was in Kansas City. The Kansas City courtroom is a room at the immigration building there with a televideo feed. You sit at a desk, the government sits next to you, and everybody talks to the television set. That's how all hearings are conducted in Kansas City.
The judge was in another venue.
The judge is here in Kansas City.
In Chicago.
Yes, here in Chicago, if I've misspoke.
We're talking about credibility?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they use translation service, right?
That's correct. One of many. I couldn't tell you who.
So they could be any place in the United States. The translator could be.
That's correct. Usually they're over the telephone. More frequently they're on a telephone, which is in the Chicago office with the judge. So therefore their voice is transmitted from the telephone speaker through the video telecommunications device. You hear it over the TV. then you answer. So it's feasible but arduous.
Is the camera fixed?
No, the camera is not fixed. Both cameras are movable for both focal length and focal depth.
And who controls the cameras?
Both sides control their own camera, meaning the government counsel can control the view of the judge, but I believe also the judge can control the view of himself. I've seen them adjust it so it just focuses on him or widens out to view a translator that's present.
Thank you.
But I'll make sure I have this correct. Your translator was in Chicago.
I believe. I honestly, without looking at the administrative record, I'm not sure. Typically, in my experience, since I was not the trial attorney, in a language other than Spanish, you use a translation service that comes through the telephone. The court here is well equipped with Spanish translators who appear in person, although in the courtroom with the judge here in Kansas City. But for this case, since it was French, it's most likely a service over the telephone. And I don't know that that's truth or not. Hopefully government counsel may be able to clear that up for me, because I don't know.
The service then would be in neither courtroom?
It would be in neither courtroom. It would be at an undetermined location because they're coming in through a telephone service.
They listen and then...
Yeah.
I haven't said the word Rube Goldberg. I'm not going there at this court at this juncture. For the last piece of the credibility issue, the judge complained about his unclear persecution. Mr. Tandia testified clearly that the main thrust of his disdain for the government was the Arabization of education. Mr. Tandia repeatedly testified that he wished to be taught in French, he wished to remain a francophone, to maintain his French speaking, and that was the thrust. In 1994, when he was a child, he was, and I use that term loosely, he was involved in a mass demonstration of children. The testimony is that they ranged in age from 8 to 6 to 20, and they took to the streets in their small town and protested the Arabization. This theme is continued through his testimony as his protestation. He was affiliated with the now outlawed political party, the UFD, and he was also a Sonique, which suffers, as the country reports indicate, societal discrimination. But the main thrust of his political protestation was the Arabization of education. That's the credibility analysis, which we would put forth is A, non-material to the claim of persecution, and B, it's not specific nor cogent. These pieces are not, in fact, incredible. They're not, in fact, contradictory. The second piece then becomes the judge finds that there is no persecution. And I'm going to have to read these decisions at 30,000 feet with honey-roasted peanuts, because although I didn't argue it in my brief, as I read the judge's decision again, I saw a pattern to his analysis that I've actually argued in front of this court before in Sakaj v. Gonzalez that was decided last year in March of 2006.
I think Judge Bauer mentioned one time maybe it was cut and paste?
It's not cut and paste so much with this particular decision. It is, here is a piece of evidence. It's much like picking apart the mosaic that I walked by on my way to the court today and looking at each tile and saying, well, that's pretty, and that's pretty, and leaving with a pile of tiles and saying there is no mosaic. If you look at the judge's burden of proof, number two in his decision, he discusses, respondents submitted numerous documents in support of his claim. He outlines those. However, none of these documents specifically establish respondent was persecuted on account of his political activities, nor do they establish he has a well-founded fear of persecution. Then he picks up, in support of the claim, he submits an affidavit. Well, this affidavit does not make any mention of participation and fails to establish respondent's fear of persecution, that his fear of persecution is objectively reasonable. Although the affidavit says, I am his cousin, I am from Mauritania, I was a UFD member, and I was persecuted. He submits a this is another note from a cousin who's also been persecuted. Although it doesn't indicate any fact relating to respondent's claim of persecution, nor does it state any respondent should fear return to Mauritania. His uncle testified also, I'm from Mauritania, I'm a UFD member, I was persecuted, we all fear for his return. In reviewing the documentary evidence relating to country conditions, the courts note, however, the country report evidence does not establish that respondent, a Francophone Sonique member, was persecuted in the past or will be persecuted in the future. This is Sakaj v. Gonzalez, Your Honor. It is an improper analysis of the evidence. The judge did not consider it as a whole. He didn't take it all and look at it and say, what does it all tell me? You can't rip the pages out of the book one by one and say, this page tells me nothing. I'll save the rest for rebuttal if there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. My name is Greg Kelch, and I represent the Attorney General. Mr. Tandia told his story of persecution to an asylum officer, an IJ, and the BIA. But the story keeps changing, and it is changing in material ways. It was reasonable for the IJ to find Mr. Tandia to be not credible, and Mr. Tandia fails to cite record evidence that compels a contrary conclusion. I will start with the IJ's observations about the inconsistencies as to the dates that Mr. Tandia says that he attended private school and resumed political activity. The first point I'd like to make is that all of the arguments that petitioner is raising here today, he could have raised with the IJ. This is not a case of gotcha. The IJ confronted Mr. Tandia during the hearing about the inconsistency. It happened at page 273. He said, sir, in your revised asylum application, you are saying that you resumed political activity in January of 1998, at the time that you transferred to a private school. Here in this hearing, now you're saying this all happened in December of 2000. Why the difference? If Mr. Tandia had misspoke, he could have told the IJ, I'm nervous, I misspoke. If there was a translation error, he could have said, I've been saying December 2000 all along. There must be a problem with this translation. Then we could take the tapes to somebody else and see who's right. He didn't give those explanations. What he said was, I transferred to another school, but it was not a private school. It was a different school. That's entirely different from the revised asylum application. And this is not a minute detail. This changes the entire theory of his case, especially as regards to the August 2000 arrest. If you look at his revised asylum application, it paints a certain timeline. 1994, he's demonstrating against the Arabicizing policies of the government. He's arrested, he's persecuted, scared away from political activity. January 1998, he resumes this demonstrating activity, simultaneous with enrolling himself in a French-speaking private school. He's getting ready to take his final exams in August of 2000 to graduate. The police arrest him, detain him for 4 months. He is no longer able to graduate and achieve higher education in Mauritania ever. Now, look at how everything changes when you plug in these new dates that he gave at his testimony. 1994, arrested, persecuted, scared away. But in 1998, starts taking review courses so he could prepare himself for the next stage of his education. August 2000, he says he's arrested so that he cannot graduate. But yet, he's saying that in December of 2000, he did, in fact, go on to attend classes in a private school. So it begs the question, then what were the ramifications of this August 2000 arrest? If, in fact, he was able to somehow take these exams or graduate and to go on and to continue his education, is really the heart of this case, then, the supposed 1994 arrest and persecution, where he appears not to have been persecuted ever again for the next 6 years? And also, it begs the question of why was his passport issued? Why did he get a passport in December 2000? And why did he take steps to come to the United States in the following June, if in fact he was enrolled in a private school and continuing with his education? When you look at the case overall, the inconsistencies are startling. You start with his original asylum application. It's prepared by his uncle, Bokar Tandia, and it says nothing about attending a private school in January of 1998. Then he submits this revised asylum application with the assistance of his counsel, where he goes on at length to explain that this revised application is to correct all the mistakes that occurred in the prior application. And he goes on to explain that in January of 1998, he resumed political activity and transferred to a private school. And in fact, to bolster his claim, he even attached his private school records from the El Hajj Omar Tal private school. That tends to corroborate his assertion that in January of 1998, he was studying at El Hajj Omar Tal. Then at his testimony, he's saying that from January 1998 to December 2000, He was at another school, but it was not a private school. And then look also at even his opening brief. The inconsistency continues. On page 9, he writes, Petitioner did not resume any political activities until December 2000. At that time, he was attending a private school that taught in French. And even further on in his opening briefs, he still cannot put together a consistent story. On page 9, referring to his August 2000 arrest, he says, Petitioner could not retake his final exam. Petitioner did not receive a degree and thus could not obtain any higher education. On page 13, where he's trying to explain how he started private school in December 2000, he says, It was not until 2000 that he officially regained his status as a senior with the ability to graduate. So what was he doing from January 1998 to 2000, and what were the ramifications of that August 2000 arrest? So at that point, we come back to the standard of review. Was it reasonable at that point for the immigrant, for the IJ, to begin questioning Mr. Tandia's credibility? Had Tandia provided a consistent, detailed, and plausible explanation of what he was doing and why he was being persecuted? Even if his explanation of appeal are inconsistent, there's no compelling record evidence that shows that he was being credible with the immigration judge when he testified.
All this stuff about the, you know, his credibility and everything, but the issue of persecution, it seems that there's a primary concern is that he's having to be taught in Arabic as opposed to French, and that this is the whole deal here. I can understand why he doesn't like it and that sort of thing, but does this all amount to persecution even?
Probably not. But the reason that I answer it that way, Your Honor, is that the IJ's decision in this case was limited to credibility. He didn't go on to make a merits determination. And so, therefore, we are not here today to actually take on the merits of this argument. If you should find that the record compels the determination that he either provided credible testimony or that all the documentary evidence establishes, compels a conclusion that he was persecuted, then the case has to go back to the BIA for them to then address the merits of this case. This decision is limited to credibility.
Credibility made via telephone and through translation.
Well, yes, but again, Your Honor, first of all, you know, this is not entirely by telephone here. This is a video conference. The immigration judge can see Mr. Tandia. He can see the immigration judge.
I know how it works.
Exactly, but you know, it's as I'm showing you here with regards to these differences in dates. This is not about, you know, a twinge of his cheek or a shake of his shoulder.
Well, that's true, and you're staying away from that sort of observational thing. But nevertheless, wasn't the first one thrown out because of the problem with translation?
He had a hearing in May of 2003, and his counsel argued that there were translation errors, and the government agreed, and they gave him a new hearing, exactly like they should have. Now, in this appeal before the BIA, they didn't make another motion to have a new hearing for translator errors.
Is there a transcript prepared or just on tape right now?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Is a transcript, a written transcript prepared of the hearing, or is it just still on tape?
No, there is. And the administrative record provides both of the hearings, the one in May 2003 and the one in June of 2001, I believe it was, or 4. Pardon me. I submit to you that really the glaring inconsistencies that go to the heart of this case as to the January 1998, December 2000 distinction, that's probably enough alone to uphold the IJ's conclusions. But I'll move on to this business about his allegations of future persecution for leaving Mauritania. As the IJ noted, this came up toward the end of the hearing where the IJ is wrapping up and asking Mr. Tandia for all of the reasons why he fears persecution. And he said, you know, member of the UFD, member of this tribe. Okay, sir, anything else? And he said, I left the country to go abroad. There's no record evidence here that members of the Sonic tribe are prohibited from leaving Mauritania. No evidence that they are persecuted upon their return. As the IJ noted, the government issued him a passport, and he had to use that passport, presumably had to use the passport when he left. It doesn't seem plausible that Mauritania...
He bribed somebody to get it, right?
Excuse me?
He bribed somebody to get it, didn't he?
Apparently so. And that would provide an explanation for how he got the passport. But that wouldn't provide an explanation for why he fears that the government will persecute him for having left the country. And those are two different concepts. That is, evidence that would corroborate that would be something like some evidence that members of the Sonic tribe or whatever are not permitted to leave Mauritania.
Didn't he have a relative that said that was the case? Not permitted to leave the country, but be arrested on his return?
My time's expired. May I continue? I'm not aware of that, and I don't see it cited in his opening brief or actually in his argument to the BIA.
Well, I thought I saw it in the IJ, but I'll check it.
But can I make one more quick point, and then I will sit down? I just want to note that on this point, this is a specific and cogent reason. Even if the board should ultimately disagree, had you done your own factual analysis, it is reasonable for the IJ to look at that and begin to doubt his credibility on that basis. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counselor, you have 1 minute.
I think I can go to that, girl.
Two rapid points, and I'll go in backwards order from the passport forward. The passport is important because he left through Senegal. The record indicates that he got his passport through bribery, got a U.S. Visa through the United States Embassy, and then left Mauritania, got to Senegal, and came to the United States. So arguably, the government may not even know he left. And so they may then want to know whether or not how he got his passport, how he managed to get out. Again, the immigration judge's decision says validly issued passport, yet the testimony says through bribery. As far as the discrepancies between the dates, I would supplant that it's arguably the remnants of a shell game. The issue is he was in education from 1998 to 2000. In August of 2000, he was arrested to prevent him specifically from taking his exams. That was the result of that arrest. Even though he may have been able to resume in December of 2000, his ability to take those final exams was over. His ability for higher education in Mauritania was finished. That was the effect of that. Whether or not it was in the private school, he said, or where he was, or what the communication error was, the effect and the testimony regarding the August 2000 arrest has remained consistent, and that's the persecution. He suffered persecution in 94, and in 2000, he's due the onus of past persecution. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court has finished the call of the day, and therefore we will rise until the next scheduled oral argument tomorrow.